20 years ago, communism was declared dead for all intents and purposes. Today, we're seeing what Ian Bremmer calls the development of a form of state capitalism, where markets become a tool of the government. Mr. Bremmer is the president of Eurasia Group, a political risk research and consulting firm. His latest book, The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations, is published by Portfolio. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hi.
Thanks for having me this morning.
Wasn't the fall of communism a victory for the free market?
It was. It was a victory for democracy, and it was a victory for the free market, but it turned out it was a transient one.
Well, the Soviet system was often described as a form of state capitalism. I get the feeling you wouldn't call it that.
I wouldn't. I would call it a centrally planned economy, and as a consequence, they had severe economic difficulties in addition to nationalities problems and the rest.
So what's the big difference between a planned economy and state capitalism?
Well, with globalization over the last 40 years, you had massive, unprecedented global economic growth, but it was increasingly in the hands of the private sector in multinational corporations. And this, of course, was a direct threat to dictatorships all over the world. And so what they did was use the tools of the market, but maintaining ultimate control in the hands of the state. No free rule of law. No separation and balance of powers, no transparency around contracts, and the state is still the most important actor and arbiter in economic outcomes. Ultimately, a system that is incompatible with free market capitalism.
Although there seems to be some kind of an uneasy alliance between the two in a country like China, because China seems to be functioning to some degree as a free market economy, despite the fact that the Chinese government calls itself a communist government.
I don't think China's communist. I think that's certainly true. I'd call it state capitalist. I mean, there isn't rule of law on the ground in China. If you have a problem with your investment, you're not going to a judge or a lawyer to litigate. And there's no question that the Chinese government has needed access historically to Western investment. But, of course, all of that changed in the last 18 months. And although the Chinese economy had been incrementally opening very slowly, that's changed. And we've hit the tipping point. That is the big story here, is that the free market economies are doing unprecedentedly historically badly. It's politically indefensible for their leaders to support free market principles. And the countries that are doing the best out of this crisis are those where the state's dominant.
Because they see what's happened over the past 2 years as evidence that the free market has failed?
Well, the reason I called my book The End of the Free Market. I was in here in New York about a year ago, and the vice foreign minister of China was coming into town. They gave me a call and asked if I would be around to exchange views. And this is, of course, in the midst of the financial crisis. And he's sitting across from me, and the first question he asked me after we exchanged our greetings was, "So, Ian, now that the free market has failed, what do you think the role of the state in the economy should be?" And look, the free market hasn't failed. The SEC has failed. The CFTC has failed. I mean, saying the free market has failed is like calling Obama a socialist. It's silly. And yet, if you're China today, knowing that you can no longer rely as much on the West for economic growth, we're not going to buy as much of their stuff. And that means they're concerned about political stability. They're going to blame us.
But China right now is still doing quite well. So are you saying that the state capitalism approach is going to work well on the short term, but not necessarily on the long term?
I think it is working well. It's clearly working well. In fact, it's worked better than anything else in the short term. There's no question that if you went to China today and asked the average Chinese, "What do you think about your government?" After 30 years of state-led 10% on average growth, Beijing Olympics, Shanghai Expo, they are happier with their government than the Americans are with the U.S. government, the Germans are with their government, Lord knows the Brits, the Greeks. But long-term, and here I'm not talking about 2 or 3 or 5 years, but ultimately the sustainability of that system is going to be in question.
Well, we've been talking about China. There are other countries that you also say practice state capitalism, and they don't look like China.
They don't. Russia, of course, is absolutely a state capitalist country, and it's much more of a resource-intensive country. They're taking resources, oil, gas, precious metals out of the ground. The state controls it. Again, no rule of law. Oligarchs are beholden to the Kremlin, and particularly Prime Minister Putin.
But in the case of Russia, some people have called it a kleptocracy. China isn't being called a kleptocracy, is it?
No. Although there are a lot of people that would talk about the endemic nature of corruption on the ground in China. Look, there are well-run state capital systems. There are badly run state capital systems. That's true of free market systems, too. The U.S. has been a badly run free market system for the last decade.
But, okay, so China and Russia, both former communist countries. But you include Saudi Arabia in the state capitalism model.
I do. And, of course, state capitalism first really became known to all of us when the national oil corporations were created and OPEC came into position, because it used to be that if you were an international oil company, you could just sign a deal with a dictator, stick a straw in the ground, give the guys some cash, and you could take the oil out. But when OPEC came into place, suddenly these national oil corporations belonging to the states had their own straws. And so if you were a multinational corporation, you were out of business. You had to do something else.
Well, in some cases, in Venezuela, we actually see the state taking back control. But there were some Scandinavian countries. Norway would you have called that state capitalist when they got involved in drilling for oil?
I wouldn't. 2 points about state capitalism. First is that the state is the principal actor in the economy, not the private sector. But secondly, no rule of law. The state is using the markets for ultimately political purposes, not economic purposes. And I think we need to recognize, I'm not standing here saying that state capitalism is always a bad system. It's just like looking at democracy. We all know that a liberalized advanced democracy is the most stable political system out there. But if you try to put democracy in a system that isn't ready for it, like Afghanistan or Gaza, you get very bad results. A properly regulated free market economy is the most effective economic system out there. And yet, if you try to stick one in to authoritarian regime with state capitalism, it'll fall apart. So we need to recognize that there are reasons that these governments are doing what they are.
What about a place like Singapore, which seems to be thriving despite the fact that it definitely has a kind of a totalitarian government?
Well, first of all, huge wealth. 3.5 million people taking advantage of the fastest growing economic region in the world. But also, despite the fact that they have an authoritarian government, there's massive transparency. There's extraordinary rule of law. They do actually uphold contracts. And I think that that's quite important. So we shouldn't fetishize elections as the only thing that brings you transparency and stability in a government.
My guest is Ian Bremmer. His latest book is The End of the Free Market: Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations? It is published by who's publishing this?
Portfolio.
Portfolio, which is a division of Condé Nast?
Of Penguin.
This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You mentioned the accusations that the Obama administration is socialist and said that's silly, and obviously it is. But by the fall of 2008, the U.S. government was bailing out banks and creating favorable terms for others to merge. Wasn't that still a kind of state capitalism?
No. Again, you have...
It wasn't free market.
I think that we need to recognize that we're not talking about hyper-capitalism with a free market. An effectively run free market economy has multinational corporations. The private sector is driving most of the decisions economically. But there is rule of law. There's a code. There are penalties. There's a referee on the field. And if you do things that are going to undermine the public weal, you should be prevented from doing so. And the fact that in the last 10 years, the referee has been off the field or not paying attention to the game is not the failure of the free market system. I think we need to recognize that. You know, a lot of people are saying that the United States is going to look like France in another 5 years, as if somehow that's the end of the American economic system. It's certainly true that we're going to regulate more. We probably regulated too little over the last 10 years. Well, the pendulum will swing too far in the other direction. But ultimately, the American system is not the one that's changing here.
You write that we're living in a G20 world now, not a G7 world. Yeah. Does the G20 world itself want to see more regulation?
Well, I think the G20 world doesn't want anything. I think what we need to recognize is the creation of the G20, the 20 sort of most important economies out there, is kind of like the Security Council. It is a large group that represents the fact of who the key players are, but they don't agree on key issues. And when the G7 evolved to become the G20, it wasn't just a coordination problem. It wasn't just herding more cats, which would be harder. It was herding cats and animals that don't like cats. And that's not actually herding. So what you end up with is a situation where on all of the big global challenges, climate change, nuclear proliferation, financial architecture, you have a complete absence of leadership and coordination. So as we're dealing with this war between state capitalism and the free markets, you're also going to have larger crises because no one is actually steering the ship.
Does state capitalism affect all industries and sectors, or are there certain areas that tend to be more heavily controlled by these states?
It's always easier to control things where you're pulling wealth out of the ground. So we see a lot of state capitalism in places where there are natural resources that can be dominated locally.
Like Russia.
Like in Russia, like in Saudi Arabia and the rest. But we also need to recognize that state capitalism is less of a threat when there is an asymmetrical power balance. So if I really need you for something, even if there's no transparency, I'm likely to keep you coming in, right? But so in China, Western companies that are investing in green energy, creating green jobs, bringing alternative technologies to China will do very well. Healthcare, people that bring healthcare to China will do really well. They haven't developed that themselves. But in 10 years' time, aviation companies, Boeing, Airbus, will probably get crushed. Automotive companies, there are lots of sectors, telecommunications companies, technology companies. Microsoft is going to be in trouble long-term in China if present trends continue.
What about the emergence of a growing number of multinational corporations over the last 25 years? You mentioned a few of them. Haven't they provided a check on the tendencies of state capitalist countries?
They've provided a big check on those tendencies in the West and for other countries as they've needed them. The question is, how much are they needed? It used to be that China desperately needed foreign direct investment. They needed capital. In the last 18 months, they don't need foreign capital. They have domestic capital. Used to be they really needed technology for everything. Everything in China was a greenfield site. Now they have a lot of their own technology. The West has had their technology ripped off. They have cybersecurity problems. They're getting very skittish about it. Google went public, but everyone's saying this privately. So you have this asymmetry. And if you're China right now looking at the West, you're saying, my God, they're not going to buy our stuff anymore. We need to decouple economically from the West.
What do you think China learned more from, watching the West or watching what happened when the Soviet Union fell?
I think they learned different lessons. They learned when the Soviet Union fell that a centrally planned economy was unsustainable for them because popular constituencies were going to want more and more and more. They were going to have to provide growth. They learned from what happened in the West in the last 2 years that opening up the markets, this unfettered free market access, is dangerous. And not only that, but they must point the finger, because in case the West doesn't work long term, they need someone to blame. They need to say the U.S. dollar is not the reserve currency.
Well, in Russia, there people who have amassed wealth have found themselves arrested or in exile. Is that part of the problem? Do they fear that if somebody gets too wealthy, they might challenge the status quo?
I think that they fear that when you have very strong development of elites that are independent from the state, independent actors, that they will rightly try to influence the state in their political decision-making. If they don't like it, they'll try to overturn it. Shades of Mikhail Khodorkovsky from Yukos. The Chinese are never going to allow Khodorkovsky to develop, not if they can help it.
But it's interesting, in China, people do can make huge profits. Is that because it's in the best interest of the Chinese government at the moment to allow that? Might they pull back if the situation got out of hand as far as they were concerned?
It's an interesting challenge. I mean, I would certainly say that for the past 10, 20 years, the Chinese had incrementally been moving in a direction where they had allowed more private sector development, but not in the last 24 months. That's changed dramatically. So as a consequence, we have seen this unprecedented change. We're in a world today where everyone wants to focus on Goldman Sachs, the Big Short. The reality is the world has changed more in the last 18 months than at any time since World War II. And we're not actually addressing that.
But what happens in these countries when economic growth goes into decline? So far, Putin is safe, but hasn't Russia been going through serious problems despite its controlled economy?
Well, Russia, of course, is now with oil prices back up, and I think it's, $58 is baked into their budget. They're looking much more stable. Putin has consolidated more power in his own personal hands than any other major authoritarian state. But we need to recognize that unlike Europe, unlike Japan, the United States, Brazil, India, in China, they are politically massively vulnerable to a sudden economic downturn. If we have a big economic downturn in the United States, you can vote out the government, but you're not going to get rid of the Supreme Court. In China, if you actually have a severe economic downturn, it is the Chinese government's fault. Right? In India, you have growth in spite of the Indian government. Kleptocrats and corrupt folks, you find entrepreneurs getting around them. In China, your growth in the last 30 years has been because of the Chinese government. It's great when you have upside. It is dangerous when you have downside.
In the past, we heard that with economic development, more of a free market economy, these totalitarian governments would become less oppressive and less repressive. But that hasn't happened. So were all of those predictions just simply fantasies of free market capitalists?
We did. We declared the end of the state, that corporations were coming, and we declared the end of authoritarianism. It was all going to be democratic. And those two things proved incredibly false and premature. Look at all these movies, you know, that you saw that talked about these corporate-run dystopias, RoboCop, a network I talk about in the book, and the rest. Those are ridiculous. Naomi Klein came out and she was talking, no logo, that corporations were taking over everything. If there's one thing that we should learn in the last 18 months, the state is back.
Well, we've been seeing a lot of problems in the European Union. Economic and political. They're all democracies, but they're democracies to varying degrees. How does this apply to them?
Well, I think the problem we have in Europe is that the most successful ever experiment of the free market system was the creation of the world's largest coordinated economy, the Eurozone. And in the last 18 months, we're seeing an unprecedented challenge to the sustainability, the viability of that creature. Now, I think the Eurozone will stay together, but I'll tell you, there's a real risk that it doesn't. Maybe it's only 5% in the next few years, but there's a real risk the Germans pull out, the Europeans can't get it together. And the fact is that the perception of the international markets looking at what's happening in Europe right now is this system is unsustainable.
Well, many American conservatives point to Europe and say that it's all socialist and they don't want to see the United States go in that direction.
Yeah, I think that is wonderful political rhetoric. And the reality is that the Europeans have been overspending. The United States has too, but the Europeans, especially in the South, have done it to a much greater degree. The good news about Europe is that it's reached a sufficient crisis they're now taking seriously. The bad news is it may be too late. The good news in the United States is that we actually have a lot more rope to hang ourselves with. The bad news is we're probably going to use it.
Ian Bremmer is president of Eurasia Group, the world's leading global political risk research and consulting firm. He's written for The Wall Street Journal, The Washington Post, Newsweek, Foreign Affairs, and a lot of other publications. He's written a number of books as well, and his most recent, the one we've been discussing, is The End of the Free Market, Who Wins the War Between States and Corporations. It is published by Portfolio. Thank you so much for being with us.
Leonard, a real pleasure to be here.